I offer my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, welcome to this week's episode of the Gita series. This is Preem, your friend from Team Radio Sai. And I'm coming to you live from our studios at the Sri Satya Sai Media Center. I couldn't join you last week. I was on a different assignment, so I could not come to you live. But here we are to continue our pilgrimage on this Gita series, what we refer to as the Triune Pilgrimage, a pilgrimage which synthesizes all the three parts of Bhakti, Jnana and Karma. And Bhakti is that central gel that brings the ability to connect our mundane activities, our mundane duties to that supreme goal of Jnana. And the chapters that we are going through now, starting from the 9th chapter, the 10th chapter that we're dealing with today, and the 11th and 12th chapter hereafter, fundamentally speak about this quality of bhakti, this tool of bhakti that Bhagwan has given all of us. We are in the 10th chapter, the Vibhuti Yoga. We started it a couple of weeks back. We covered two verses last time, verses 6 and 7. But we also completed before that a part of the fifth verse. In the fourth and fifth verse, we saw how Krishna was listing out the various attributes that are to be recognized as being vibhutis or divine expressions of the glory of the Supreme Lord. The points that we covered last time, we saw that many qualities were listed out, buddhi, jnana, and so on and so forth. And then Krishna comes to what appeared like pairs of opposite qualities. I'm not going into all of that we covered a couple of weeks back. We'll come straight to the portion that we covered the last time around. So Krishna was speaking about bhayam and abhayam, fear and fearlessness. The fear and awe that keeps the world in order. We quoted some lines from the Sikshavali, if I'm not wrong, where Krishna, where it is said that the sun functions out of fear of the Supreme Being, the wind blows because of the fear of the Supreme Being. It is not fear as much as it is awe, right? It is this awe of that divine order that makes everything function as it must function. And he is also the fearlessness that manifests as the quality of adventurousness that enables us to believe that we can go beyond this human state and reach that divine state. Both fear and fearlessness are thus the vibhutis of the Lord. Then Krishna says, ahimsa, non-injury, not wanting to harm another, just as one doesn't want to be harmed by another. Swami says that this is the most basic quality of morality, most basic quality of humanness itself that is present in everyone. Ahimso, ahimsa, paramo dharma. Swami would say that the basis of dharma is this ahimsa. And that is an expression of the Lord. Then Krishna says, samata, equanimity. For equanimity from that allows us to maintain a balance in different physical conditions, different weather conditions. That's the most basic samatha that all of us have. To the samatha of being able to deal with the vicissitudes of life. Leading up to the samatha, which is referred to as samadhi, where it is complete equanimity, you're not perturbed by anything that happens around. All of these are qualities that can be put under this umbrella of samatha, equanimity. So Krishna says, all of this is a vibhuti of me. It is very easy to look at a yogi who is in samadhi and say, oh, this is a divine sight or a divine expression. But what has to be remembered is that equanimity which is within us, which allows us to go through life with a sense of balance, that is also a vibhuti of the Lord. Samatha is followed by tushtihi, contentment. Again, the ultimate contentment will only come when we are able to identify with the Atma within. But even as we go through life, we find contentment in so many small things, right? Without that small contentment, life is indeed impossible. Then Krishna says, tapaha, austerity, and accomplishment. Any accomplishment involves the ability to align our thought, word, and deed and apply ourselves. You take a resolve and you put yourself to that resolve. You work towards that. This quality itself is called tapas. That's why the wide translation or wide interpretation of this word tapas, Swami would say often in his discourses, is unity of thought, word, and deed. When you take a resolve, when you pull yourself together and you work towards that. This tapas, when it is turned towards the spiritual path, is what we refer to as tapas, as in penance. Then Krishna says, danam, or charity, that maturity that makes one understand that there is gain in selfless giving too. That attitude is danam, and that danam is also vibhuti of the Lord. Then finally Krishna says, yashaha, fame, ayashaha, and infamy too. We discussed this from what Adi Shankara says in his commentary. True fame or yasha comes when dharma is followed, right? So when dharma is an expression of the Lord, yashaha is also an expression of that same alignment to dharma, right? So that is how yasha is a byproduct of the Lord. And ayashaha is also when you don't align yourself to dharma. So in that sense, ayashaha is also a vibhuti of the Lord. There is another way of looking at the statement that ayashaha is a vibhuti. We discussed that based on a story from the life of Mother Meera, where a devotee must look at even infamy that comes to one as an expression of the gods, of God's grace, right? So that was the end of the fifth verse. The sixth verse that we discussed thereafter, Krishna says that the Saptarishis, the four great beings, that is the Brahma Kumaras who came before the Saptarishis, then Manu, from Manu comes the entire creation, that is why we are all called Manava. And Krishna says that all of these beings and their descendants have come from God. First he says that the Saptarishis and the four beings and Manu have come from me. And because everyone else has come from these entities, they are all can be looked at as being descendants of God. And we spoke about the significance of that, how we should be able to look at ourselves as Swami would say, Amritasya Putraha, and not Anritasya Putraha. The seventh verse is where the name for the chapter occurs, or from where the name for the chapter comes from. Till now, Krishna spoke about the various manifestations of his, the various vibhutis. In the seventh verse, he states, what is the effect or impact of this knowledge? Yetam vibhutim yogam cha mamayo veti tattvatah. The one who knows or recognizes these vibhutis and my connections to it. What happens to that person is what Krishna refers to here. The idea that the manifestation is separate from the God, from the idea that the manifestation or these vibhutis are separate from God, is the primary and only source for Maya. That's why Krishna says, Yo Veti, the one who knows, Vibhutim Yogam Chamama, the one who knows these vibhutis or recognizes these vibhutis, and Yogam Chamama, and their connection to me, and their being ever connected to me. So this knowledge is also very important. And what happens when one has this knowledge, one acknowledges this? He says, avikalpena yoga. He attains avikalpena yoga, undeterred or unwavering unity to me. So that was the seventh verse, the verses that we covered last time, 6 and 7. We will now go to the eighth verse. As always, we will listen to it in the voice of Brother Shyam. I'll give you a very brief meaning after that, and then we'll discuss in detail what Krishna is saying here.
Aham sarvasya prabhavo matta sarvam pravartate iti matva bhajante maam buddha bhava samanvita.
I am the source of all. From me everything flows. Therefore, the wise worship me with unchanging devotion. So that's the 8th verse of the 10th chapter. In the previous verse, Krishna had said, the one who recognizes these vibhutis as coming from me have avikalpena yoga, a state of unwavering yoga. But from looking at the vibhutis of the Lord, recognizing those bright spots, so to say, from that one has to widen the vision and one must see everything as being an expression of the Lord. We had discussed this when we were going through the 7th chapter also. There are overtones of the 7th chapter constantly here. I mentioned this in the introduction itself. You start by attributing all that is good and glorious to God, all that is sattvic to be divine, and then slowly come to the understanding that everything must have its source in God. Because there is no second source, there is only one source. So sattvic is also from God, rajasic and tamasic also must be from God. Krishna states here in this shloka, Aham sarvasya prabhavaha. I am the source of all, not just the good and the glorious, but everything. He is the ocean and every wave, be it gentle or fierce, can be formed only on the ocean and not anywhere else, isn't it? You can never have a wave that is separate from the ocean. Then he continues, Mattah sarvam pravartate. From me, everything flows. Pravartate means flows, or in this context, it is used in the sense of sustained. Pravartana means going on or carrying forward. So, Aham sarvasya prabhavaha, I am the source of all, and not just that, Mattah sarvam pravartate. The sustenance of things happen also because of me. How is the entire creation sustained? If you have a sport like football or cricket, how is the game played? You know, for that period of time from the start of the from the starting whistle to the end whistle, how do you play a game? It is organized and played because of the rules that govern the game. There is a process of scoring. There is something that is deemed as a foul, and there is a penalty for that. Like in cricket, you do a certain act, you have one run that is added to your name. In another act, it is decided to write 4 or 6 as the runs against your name. If you do something else, you're ruled as being out and sent away from the ground. It is these rules that ensure that the game is played meaningfully, isn't it? In the same way, the world as it exists needs a force to sustain it. Some cosmic order that ensures the flow of things. And however much sometimes we feel that everything is chaotic and there seems to be no method to this madness, the fact is, there is always method to this madness. That cosmic order that holds this world together is also the Lord. That is why Krishna says, Aham sarvasya prabhavaha, I am the source of all, mattah sarvam pravartate. Everything is sustained and kept in place also because of me. Then he says, iti matva, understanding this, that he is the source and the sustainer, bhajante mam, they worship me, buddhaha, the wise, bhava samanvitaha, endowed with devotion. Bhava samanvitaha can be translated as those that have merged their minds with me. A couple of verses ago, Krishna had used the term mat bhavaha, those that have aligned their mind and buddhi in such a way that you can see God shining through them, right? So when we say merged with God, minds merged with God, you are just aligning your intellect, your actions and your mind and your words in such a way that the Lord shines clearly from within. Swami had once asked a devotee this question. What is devotion? Swami had asked. After multiple answers that were given by him, Swami rejected all of them and Swami said, when your thinking becomes indistinguishable from Swami's, when you're able to think like Swami, Swami said, that is devotion. Of course, the means to get there is to consciously align our likes and dislikes, our habits, our pravartana to what Swami would like. Either way, the essence is those that recognize that everything comes from God and whatever happens, happens because of God, has ordained by God, becomes a Buddha or a wise one and worships me, bhajante mam, with a mind filled with devotion, bhava samanvita. We discussed this a few weeks back. What is Buddha? What is intelligence that makes one intelligent, really? The ability to see the subtle connections and to recognize that which is not so obvious, right? So the one who recognizes God's handiwork in all this is one who is truly a Buddha, an intelligent one. Because that is true buddhi, the ability to see God who is hidden behind this veil of this material world. Such a person, he or she, is truly worth being called intelligent or Buddha. From a devotee's point of view, if you look at it, which is certainly the right way to look at this shloka, as I said, this entire chapter is slowly edging towards or is trying to drive that idea of bhakti. So looking at this from the point of view of the devotee, the moment when a devotee recognizes the hand of Swami or presence of Swami in a situation in life, how heartening is it? I'm sure you know all of us would have gone through this at some point in time. You are in some dilemma, you're worried about something, and then suddenly you read a quote of Swami or someone sends you a discourse clip or somebody comes and tells you something absolutely random which reminds you of something that Swami might have said many years ago. How thrilled we feel at that moment. Don't we suddenly be filled with thoughts of Swami and feel comforted? I feel that state is what is referred to as bhava samanvitaha, where your feelings are filled with his presence. One of the devotees we'd interviewed a long time ago was saying she once had a meeting with her superiors and she was very upset and disturbed after that meeting. So after the meeting, she was driving back in her car and the problem was she was being given orders which she didn't want to follow. She was very perturbed with that entire discussion that she had. So she was returning in her car and she was in the traffic and she was praying to Swami. She said, Baba, what should I do? Where are you? I'm in such dilemma and I'm in such trouble. Where are you? And just then, just as these thoughts were passing her mind, she says a water tanker crosses her car. One of these water tankers which are going around the city supplying water to different societies and buildings probably. This water tanker crosses her and there is a huge picture of Swami on the water tanker. And under the picture, it was written, 24 hours at your service. Certainly 24 hours at your service was probably put by the company that was supplying the water. But imagine you are asking this question, Baba, where are you? Where are you now? And this picture of Swami drives past you and under the picture are written these words, 24 hours at your service. Imagine the thrill the devotee must have experienced at that moment. And as I said, I'm sure each one of us have had such moments and we are able to relate to the kind of feeling it fills us with. So picture what will be the state if we are able to see Swami as the source of every happening. If you are able to recognize every occurrence as being his vibhuti, we will constantly be in that state of bhava samanvita. And as devotees, it is that buddhi that we must crave and pray for, that intelligence that allows us to recognize him being hidden behind all these various situations. The pleasant ones, it is very important to recognize Swami behind the pleasant occurrences. When something goes right, when you are rewarded for something, when you are recognized for something, when something good happens to you, when you worked hard for something and at the fruition of that, it is important to remember Swami at that moment. It is equally important to remember Swami when things go wrong, right? So as devotees, we must pray and crave and seek that buddhi that allows us to see his presence behind these various happenings. We'll go to the next shloka, the 9th shloka. We'll listen to it. I'll give you a brief meaning of that and then we'll discuss in detail.
Machitta madgata prana bodhayantah parasparam kathayantascha mam nityam tushyanti charamanti cha.
With their minds focused on me, with their life centered in me, inspiring one another and always speaking of me, they live in contentment and bliss at all times. So that is the 9th verse of the 10th chapter. This is a beautiful verse that describes the nature of a devotee and how a devotee should probably develop devotion, right? Both ways, nature of a devotee and what one must do to develop that devotion. In the previous verse, Krishna had said, their minds are filled with bhava, having recognized God in everything. So what happens to such a person? If you're able to see Swami's vibhuti everywhere, if you're able to see every happening and occurrence in your life as an expression of his presence, what happens to such a person? How does this person go about living one's life? Mat chittaha. Mat chittaha. With their minds wholly absorbed in me. How can anything else interest a devotee? The best example is that of the Gopikas. Their minds were so absorbed in Krishna, there was nothing that they could even think about, right? Like the story about the Gopikas and Uddhava that I had shared when we were discussing the verse where Krishna speaks about Ananya Chintana, right? Where when Uddhava tried to teach them Vedanta, a Gopika by name Neeraja says, "Oh great Uddhava, we have only one mind and that one mind is with Krishna. So we don't have another mind to comprehend your philosophies." Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, before he became Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, was a Sanskrit scholar and he was very famous for his scholarship by name Nimai Pandit. Students from very far would come to learn under him, learn Sanskrit and grammar under him. But slowly he was being drawn into this Madhura Bhava, into Krishna consciousness. So even as he would be eating or doing some task, he would suddenly say, "I hear Krishna's anklets," and he would run out or go into a trance. One day it happens that he's taking a class and he's taking a Sanskrit grammar class, Panini grammar he's teaching, and he suddenly loses himself in a trance thinking about Krishna. And then he realizes that he was teaching his students, he's in the middle of this class, and then he gathers himself and he looks at all of these students who are staring at him. Then the students tell him, "Guruji, this is not the first time this is happening. For the past 10 days you have not taken any class for us. Every time you begin a class, you get lost in Krishna Bhava like this and you're not able to continue the class." Then Chaitanya tells them, "If you want to learn grammar, go to some other teacher. I can teach you no more. The only path I can teach you, I can show you, is the one of Namasmarana." Because Machittaha, the devotee is one whose mind is completely absorbed in me, Krishna says. Then he says, mat gata ప్రాణాః మచ్చిత్తాః మద్గత ప్రాణాః దేర్ లైఫ్ ఇస్ సెంటర్డ్ ఆన్ మీ. వీ ఆల్వేస్ యూజ్ దిస్ ఫ్రేజ్, యు ఆర్ క్లోజర్ టు మీ దెన్ లైఫ్, ఆర్ యు ఆర్ యాజ్ డియర్ యాజ్ లైఫ్ టు మీ. ఫార్ ఎ డివోటీ, ద లార్డ్ ఇస్ ద మోస్ట్ ప్రెషియస్ పొసెషన్. యాజ్ వీ హవ్ డిస్కస్డ్ బిఫోర్, వాట్ ఈస్ ద డిఫరెన్స్ బిట్వీన్ అ డివోటీ ఆఫ్ ద లార్డ్ అండ్ వన్ హూ ఇస్ డివోటెడ్ టు ద వర్ల్డ్? The one who is worldly, the one who is worldly uses the Lord to gain the world, because the person is actually devoted to the world. He or she is actually devoted to the gains that the world has to give, and he turns to God to secure what the world has to give. So in that sense, the person is a devotee of the world who turns to God for help. But for the true devotee, the world is only a means to attain the Lord. The world, the relationships in the world, the duties in the world become a means to attain the Lord. So he or she uses the world to attain the Lord. Because for the devotee, it is the Lord and the Lord alone who is dear, not even one's own life. There's this beautiful story that we often hear, you all must have heard it in the radio, where there was this devotee of the Lord who always said that if I have a problem, the Lord will come and save me. And once the town where he lives in is struck by a deadly storm and it's pouring, the streets are getting flooded and everybody is being evacuated, this devotee of the Lord stands in his house and he says, no, my Lord will come and save me. The story goes that a person comes in a boat. The devotee tells him, no, my Lord will come and save me. Then a person comes in a helicopter and says that, come, we're evacuating the whole town. You'll be drowned by the floods if you don't move. And he says, no, my Lord will come and save me. I will wait till my Lord comes. Oftentimes the story is narrated with this ending, that finally this man goes to heaven and he's very upset with God and he looks at God and says, I waited for you and you didn't come. And then the Lord says, I came to you in the form of a boatman. I came to you in the form of a person in a helicopter, and you fail to recognize me. Fine as it is, this beautiful story, I often would look at the story and say that, no, there's something wrong with the story. And I would envision the story with a different ending, where finally the man drowns and he is in the presence of the Lord, and the Lord looks at him and says, my dear child, I sent you somebody on a boat to save your life. I sent you somebody on a helicopter to save your life, but you stood there and said, oh Lord, to be with you, to have you in my presence is more important to me than this life itself. Because you chose me over your life, that is why you are here in my presence today. Because a devotee is the one who chooses the Lord over his life. Mat gata pranaha. Then Krishna says something beautiful. How do these people spend their time? And this is where the message for each one of us is, the direction that Krishna gives to each one of us is, how do these people spend their life? Bodhayantaha parasparam kathayantaha mam nityam. Bodhayantaha means to teach or to enlighten. Bodhayantaha parasparam, they enlighten each other. Parasparam means mutually or amongst each other. Kathayantaha cha mam, they share stories about me. Kathayantaha or kathayati means to speak descriptively, actually, not necessarily stories. Kathayantaha mam means they speak about me descriptively. They share leelas about me. They share stories about me. So Krishna says, having seen me as the source of all, having made me the center of their thoughts, and looking upon me as dearer than life, how do they spend their time? They speak about me, describing me, and sharing with each other the lessons they learn along this journey. They do not find anything else as being worthwhile. That is why this is a beautiful description of a devotee as well as a means to foster that devotion. during our Satya to Sai episodes, we would often quote this exchange between Swami and a devotee who came in the 1940s. Even as they were coming regularly, they could see that the crowds around Swami were slowly swelling. Then when Swami shifted to Prashanti Nilaya Mandir in 1950, Swami had become a little distant in the sense that now Swami had his own mandir, he had his own room, his own dining hall, and slowly there was a darshan time when you had to go and sit. Swami had to call you for an interview. So they could see that the distance between Swami and devotees were growing, and we are talking about the 1950s, you can only imagine the years later. So one of the devotees put this question to Swami. Swami, you are saying that in the days to come, tens of thousands of people would come to Prashanti Nilayam. How will they feel close to you? And what can we say now when the physical form is no more visible to the eyes? The devotees asked the question of how to feel close when Swami was there, but not available as much physically like in the Pathamandir days. Today we are facing a situation where Swami is there, but not available at all physically. So this was the reply that Swami gave, which is important for us even today. Swami said, "E prashanti nilayam prangamlo kurchoni Swami kathalu cheptuntaru," meaning sitting in this precincts of prashanti nilayam, they will narrate to each other stories and leelas of Swami, and that is how they will feel close to me. Imagine today, even sitting in prashanti nilayam is not quite possible, isn't it? But throughout the world, devotees of Swami are sitting and sharing their learnings and experience. Bodhayantaha parasparam kathayantaha cha. And this is an experience of each one of us. When we listen to about Swami, we feel close to him, don't we? There were times when Swami would be inside the interview room or in the bhajan hall speaking to some devotees, and we would be sitting outside in the mandir. Near the Krishna statue or sometimes near the water cooler. That's where we would sit in a group together waiting for Swami to come out. And even as we were sitting there, we would be sitting and sharing experiences that we would have heard from a devotee or we would have read in a book amongst ourselves. And sometimes the interesting thing is, even those students, even those boys who would serve Swami physically, when an interview is going on, they had to be sitting outside. They would also come and sit with us and would join in this satsang. Why? Because even physical proximity is not true proximity to Swami. Physical proximity is only valuable as long as it enables this process of making you a machittaha, one whose mind is focused on Swami. Right? So, well, that's a different point. So Krishna tells these Buddhaha, the wise, how do they spend their time? They share their learnings amongst themselves and share descriptions of the Lord. And when do they do that? Is there any specific time during the day when they do that? Bodhayantaha parasparam kathayantaha cha mam nityam. They do it always because nothing else is worth spending their time with. Why so? Krishna says, tushyanti cha ramanti cha. This way they are tushyanti cha, and they are content, ramanti cha, and they draw delight. We often see this when someone buys a new house or has taken up a new job and they love the job that they do, they can't stop talking about it, right? To the point of boring the other person. You sit with them and have a conversation, and all that they can talk about is probably this new event that is happening in their life, or whatever their new possession or the new relationship they have in their life. For a devotee, when the Lord becomes dearer than life, every fascinating happening is only a vibhuti of the Lord. What else will she or he speak about? What else is worth speaking about for such a person? As Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, "I have found the highest joy in Krishna Bhava. What will I teach you Panini's grammar now?" I think I had read this in one of Howard Murfitt's books. One of the things that he finds very fascinating when he first comes to Swami, comes to Prashanthi Nilayam and then later to Whitefield, I guess. Or I think this is even before he actually has a tryst with Swami, when he meets a lot of devotees of Swami, and he finds that all of these devotees have one trait in common. That is, they cannot stop talking about Swami. Any topic and any conversation that you strike with them will eventually be steered towards Swami. And this was not done in an artificial way to promote Swami or anything. This they did most naturally, and he says that their face would glow and they would start speaking about Swami with so much love and joy. When I first joined Swami's college in Vrindavan, this is the very same quality that I found in my teachers, and the quality that fascinated me. For them, every event, every topic, even a joke would remind them about Swami, and they would relate something that is associated with Swami. That's why two beautiful words are used here. Tushyanti cha ramanti cha. Ramante means to enjoy. When I enjoy an ice cream, say, or being with another person gives me a lot of joy, this is a feeling that arises because of interaction with something that is outside of me. Interaction with another entity, right? Adi Shankara says, Ramanti, in his commentary, he says, Ramanti is like the joy experienced in the company of the beloved. Tushyanti means satisfaction. If you're not satisfied, you will not find contentment in anything. If you're not happy, you cannot be made happy. That sounds very paradoxical, isn't it? But it is absolutely true. Only when you have a certain contentment in you, you can find more contentment outside. And only when you have a little bit of happiness in you, you can find happiness outside. And that's what happens when people get depressed. The ability to be happy seems to have evaporated, and that's why nothing makes them happy, right? So that's why Tushyanti describes the nature where the devotee is happy and satisfied with the state. Because the devotee is happy and satisfied, he derives joy from the act of talking about the Lord with another person. Because he or she is satisfied by the thoughts of the Lord, he or she derives happiness by sharing it with others. That's why Tushyanti and Ramanti. This shloka again is interpreted differently by different commentators, saying that Machittaha, when Krishna says Machittaha, it means someone who is the sankalpas and vikalpas of the mind have been completely aligned with that of the Lord. So there is no maya, the one does not see any distinguishing features in the world. Madgata pranaha means the prana is now risen and it is aligned with the atma. It's a yogic practice. Different people have probably different ways of interpreting this shloka and what is mentioned here. But I feel it makes absolute sense to see this verse as we just saw it now. Because it is more practical and it makes sense to look at it from the point of view of devotion and the qualities of a devotee. In the previous chapter, Krishna spoke about all karmas or duties being performed as an offering to God, right? Here he is saying Shravanam and Kirtanam are what they love to indulge in, because the taste is now refined. Devotee's taste is now refined to notice the Lord in everything. And when your taste is refined in that manner, I'm using the word taste, but it is the same as buddhi, right? Once you have acquired that intelligence, the ability to see the subtle presence of the Lord in everything, the mind becomes sensitized only to recognize that, only to see Him. And the only pastime, the only way one passes one's time is through Shravanam and Kirtanam. So that was the ninth verse. We'll listen to the 10th verse. We'll see what Krishna is saying in that one and how is it connected to whatever he's been saying so far.
Tesham satata yuktanam bhajatam priti purvakam dadami buddhi yogam tam yena mamupayanti te.
To those who are always devout and who worship me with love, I give the power of discrimination which leads them to me. So that's the 10th verse of the 10th chapter. A student of Vedanta will listen to all of what we've been telling. Oh, they tell stories to each other, they're reveling in the joy about God and all that. And they will ask, wait. What does all this have to do with jnana? The first few chapters, Krishna spoke only about how jnana is everything. A jnani is the greatest. What happens when you have this jnana? I think later in the fourth chapter also, Krishna, there's a portion where Krishna speaks about this. Oh, if you have jnana, you're this. If you're a jnani, you're this and that. And he told Arjuna, you should try and become a jnani. What does all this have to do with jnana? Krishna had said in the 22nd verse in the previous chapter, Ananyas chintayanto mam ye janaha paryupasate tesham nityabhiyuktanam yogakshemam vahamyaham. The same assurance that Krishna gave in that verse, Krishna gives in this shloka too. If you are focused on me, if you are constantly thinking of me, if you take delight in only discussing me, I will give whatever you need in this world and whatever you need beyond this world too. When a devotee is thus attached to God, will not God give the devotee the wherewithal to attain that ultimate too? Will God keep away that ultimate from this devotee who is completely dependent only on the Lord? Krishna says here in the shloka, Tesham satata yuktanam, those who are ever steadfast. Yukta is one who is focused on God. Satata yukta means one who is always focused on the Lord. Satata yukta is the same as nityabhiyukta. Satata yuktanam, and in that 22nd verse, nityabhiyuktanam. A nitya abhiyukta is the same meaning, one who is constantly focused on him. So, tesham satata yuktanam, to those who are ever steadfast, bhajatam priti purvakam, who is worshipping me with love, priti purvakam, filled with love. Again, it is very similar to paryupasate. Upasate means to worship. Paryupasate means to worship in the right manner. And the only way a worship becomes perfect, only way the worship is a right form of worship, is when there is love, right? So whoever is worshipping the Lord in this manner, he or she may say, I don't know any Vedanta. I have not read the Gita, I have not done Vipassana, Dhyana, Kundalini, Yoga. It doesn't matter. Because even if you do all that, what finally happens? You will get this Sukshma Buddhi that we've been talking about, isn't it? You will be able to see truths that miss others' eyes. When I read Vedanta, what happens? I am introduced to this idea that I am not the body, that I have lived many lives. I have had many relationships, I have had many wives, many husbands in different lives, like the discourse that Krishna gave in the second chapter to Arjuna. When you're introduced to that larger idea of life, the way you see the world will be different. The way you will look at your own family, your own children, the way you look at your own problems will be different. Why? Because now you have a buddhi, a spiritual intellect that a worldly person doesn't have. This is very similar to probably scientific knowledge, isn't it? In Vrindavan, we used to have this brilliant botany teacher, botany lecturer. One day he had told us, come, we'll go to the library. I will show you some of the books that you can refer for this particular subject that we were learning. And our campus in Vrindavan is filled with beautiful flowering plants, right? Vrindavan is known for its gardens. So as we were walking to the library, this lecturer was pointing to the plants and the different shrubs and beautiful, colorful flowers there. And he was telling us, you know, this is the scientific name of this plant. This is the genus it belongs to. You see that flower, that is actually not a flower. It's an inflorescence. The sap from this plant is used in this particular medicine. So we were seeing the same garden. We were thinking, wow, those are nice flowers. But he was seeing the whole botany syllabus in front of him. Because he was having a buddhi that was allowing him to see things that without that buddhi we were not able to see. So when you read Vedanta, you are awakened to a subtle knowledge that was not available to you before. So Krishna says, when you have devotion to me and are focused only on me, dadami buddhir yogam. He says in this verse, dadami buddhi yogam. I will give him buddhi yogam. This is a very important statement that Krishna makes here, because if you recall in the second chapter, after speaking about Sankhya, that is about the absolute truth, in the second chapter he said, yesham te abhihita sankhye buddhir yoge tvimam shrunu. This which has been taught to you thus far is wisdom concerning Sankhya. Now listen to wisdom concerning yoga, or listen to buddhir yoga, right? Buddha yukto yaya partha karma bandham prahasyasi. By means of which, O Arjuna, you shall break through the bondage of all actions. This was the verse that Krishna had said in the second chapter, 39th verse to be precise. The whole discourse of the Gita is about this buddhi yoga. That knowledge, if you have, you can go through life untouched by Maya. And thereafter in the second chapter and continued in the third chapter is the discourse about karma yoga, right? That is what is referred to as buddhi yoga, the ability that allows you to go through your karmas without being attached to them. So Krishna says here, dadami buddhi yogam. I will confer this buddhi yoga, tam yena, by which mam, to me, upayanti te, they come or they reach. That means to reach me, I will confer on that person. From what we have seen in this vibhuti yoga, buddhi itself is a vibhuti of the Lord, right? That was one of the discussions that we had. Krishna starts by saying buddhir jnana. Buddhi and jnana are my vibhutis in the fourth and fifth verse that we were going through. So buddhi itself is a vibhuti of the Lord. And vibhuti means his gift, his presence being expressed. So when I become that ananya bhakta, or like what Krishna said in the previous verse, a matchitta, one who is always thinking of him, madgata pranaha, one for whom he has become the very life, will not God manifest his presence more and more? Will not God shower his vibhuti more and more? As Swami's devotees, we attach a great amount of significance to vibhuti suddenly manifesting in our homes, isn't it? In a picture of Swami or in the altar. And rightly so. Right from the 1940s, Swami has been using this as a sign of his grace, isn't it? A sign of his appreciation for someone's devotion, a sign of appreciation for a devotee. But I feel this is just symbolic. The more you turn to God, the more the Lord's vibhutis will manifest in your life. And more importantly, we will recognize it I think that's the most important point. Today, if suddenly Vibhuti starts appearing in your house, it does not mean that Swami has now come to your house. Swami was always there. Swami is omnipresent, right? Swami was always in your house. But His grace has manifested in a manner, His presence has manifested in a manner that you can recognize His presence. In the same way, the more we start turning to God, the more He will grace us in a way that we will recognize His presence. It need not necessarily be as Vibhuti, but it could be as Buddhi Yoga, a certain maturity. Something troubled me so much a few years ago. Today I am more balanced when I face the same situation, when I face the same trouble. Swami is then keeping up the promise He gave to Arjuna in this shloka. Dadami Buddhi Yogam. You are in an incredibly difficult situation, but you are able to act with clarity. Remember, Swami is keeping up this promise. Dadami Buddhi Yogam. And through these manifestations of grace, He is slowly moving us closer and closer to Him. Tam yena mam upayanti te. Through these, they are moving towards me. So this shloka can be explained purely from the point of view of Advaita, right? Knowledge cannot be spoken of as a gift. Knowledge is something that you grow into, literally, right? That's what we've been speaking about in the earlier chapters. When Swami is my Atma, this inner self is Swami, to whom is He giving and who is receiving? When you say that Dadami, when Krishna says Dadami Buddhi Yoga, it makes no sense in looking at it from the point of view of Advaita. Who is He giving what to? Is Buddhi an object that can be handed over? And if at all it can be handed over, who is He handing it over to? When I am not the mind, I am not the body, I am the Atma, and He is that Atma, who is He handing it over to? But this shloka's beauty, I feel, lies when it is looked at from the point of view of Dvaita, or at least from the point of view of Vishishta Dvaita, where you look at yourself as being a separate entity who is eventually going to become one with the Lord. So looking at these few shlokas from the point of view of devotion, from the point of view of a devotee, then you are able to recognize how to lead life in a manner that you are heading towards this. The greatest promise that Krishna is giving, that Swami has given us through the Gita, is this. Dadami Buddhi Yoga. I will give you that clarity, I will give you that Buddhi, because of which you are able to reach me. And this reaching Him is an enormous gift, right? The whole of the ninth chapter was trying to impress upon us this immensity of this, the blessing that we are talking about. You could go right up to the Brahmaloka and be caught up in the cycle of coming and going. Yes, it might take a few hundred thousand years, but nevertheless, it is not eternity. And when Krishna says, I will give you that Buddhi Yoga because of which tam yena mam upayanti te, because of which they will reach me, this is the highest blessing that is being conferred. And for that, it's very simple, right? The shlokas that we went through, as I was just saying, it is being spoken of as an expression of that devotion. But nevertheless, whenever Krishna has spoken about something like that, when He spoke about a jnani, when He spoke about a karma yogi, the whole discourse has to be looked at from the point of view as these are expressions of that divine state, but these are also sadhanas that one can take up. Right? So He says, Tesham satata yuktanam. They're always trying to focus on me. Bhajatam priti purvakam. They worship me with love. Machittaha. They're always thinking of me. We again discussed this even when we were discussing about ananya chintana. Machittaha does not mean not even one thought, stray thought other than the Lord or other related to the Lord comes. It is not like that. Every thought, every action, every endeavor is taken in a manner that it is marshalling your whole life and your whole energies towards the same Lord. Matgata pranaha. How much are you able to put yourself behind the Lord, behind what Swami likes? And then bhudayantaha parasparam katayantascha. The best way to fill time is to think of Swami, to share positive ideas that we have learned from Swami. It's a very beautiful statement that Krishna makes there, isn't it? Bodhayantaha parasparam. Nobody is more knowledgeable than you. I'm sitting here talking to all of you. It does not mean I have a message to give. It does not mean that I am more learned and I am teaching you something. We are learning from each other as devotees of Swami, as children of Swami. Each one of us have had a separate journey. Each one of us have learned something. And we have this ability to share our learnings with each other, to inspire each other. Any number of devotees whom we come in contact with as part of our job come and inspire us in a way we can't even describe. They tell us about how Swami has walked into their life, what Swami has done to them, what they did and what pleased Swami. And from there we learn a lesson, how do I please my Swami, right? And this entire lockdown has brought all of us in one living room. We are all constantly sharing our learnings, sharing our love for Swami. Somebody is telling stories of Swami. Somebody is telling descriptions of what Swami would like, what Swami would not like. When you recognize the Lord as being the most precious, nothing else is worth spending time with. And even for that recognition, that buddhi has to be given by Swami. So if anything is worth praying for, if any wealth is worth praying for, it is only this. That Swami, let me recognize you through your vibhuti in all of this. When fame comes to me, it is your vibhuti. When infamy comes to me, it is your vibhuti. When good happens, when happiness comes, sukha is your vibhuti, dukkha is also your vibhuti. Right? That's what Krishna has been emphasizing in all this. With that prayer that Swami confer on us, that sukshma buddhi that allows us to see your presence behind this veil that this world is, behind this veil that pain is, that pleasure is, bless us with that buddhi. With this thought, I most humbly offer this effort at Bhagwan's lotus feet, and I thank each one of you for your company, for your patient listening. I'll join you again next week. We'll resume our triune pilgrimage next Thursday at 10 a.m. as usual. I will not be coming back to you for the afternoon satsang this week. I will be playing out an old afternoon satsang. Please bear with me for that. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu for the next segment, Outside, Inside, Deep Inside. Till I meet you all next week, keep safe, take care. Jai Sai Ram.